right, good morning. I want to welcome everybody to this morning's workshop on the Who Is Data Accuracy Study. And I appreciate everybody who rose early to join us at 9 a.m. here in Sydney. This morning, we're going to give you a very comprehensive and in-depth look into the structure of the Who Is Data Accuracy Study. And to do that, I have two colleagues with me today who are going to essentially handle the lion's share of the presentation. The first colleague is Khalil Rashid, our compliance audit manager from ICANN. Khalil has had enormous responsibility on this project as well as a leadership role in this project, and you'll be hearing from Khalil quite often this morning. And then off to my left is Jenny Kelly, Vice President of Operations at NORC, which stands for the National Opinion Research Center. And as many of you know, NORC is the organization that we retained to help us essentially formulate the strategic and tactical approach that we're taking with respect to the Who Is Data Accuracy Study. And so between the three of us, we'll be your presenters this morning. There are other colleagues here from ICANN in the room, and we invite you to engage with us in questions as we go through the material. Most presentations will tell you to hold your questions until the presenters have finished. But this is a workshop, and as you'll see from the outline as we go forward, it really is all about the dialogue. And so what we're presenting to you today is really an opportunity for you to have a guiding hand in shaping the direction of this very important work. So let's talk a minute about the objectives for the workshop. Clearly, we want to inform you and educate you on the approach that we've taken. We think that that there are experts in all areas of the community, and many of those experts are right here with us today. And so we value your input, and we value your feedback in this process. And so we expect you to ask questions, and don't be surprised if we ask you a question in return, because again, it's all about the dialogue here to make sure we've got this right. To obtain input from the community, what we're looking for, and I hope you'll help us this morning, is to think about the international considerations or impact of this study. And I will tell you in a minute that the way we're starting here is one of sort of my famous analogies, which is you have to crawl before you walk, and you have to walk before you run. And so because this is the first comprehensive review of the Who Is database that's been undertaken by ICANN, I would suggest to you that we are crawling at this stage. We are crawling forward vigorously into an approach that will allow us to walk upright and very stridently as we embrace other Who Is related studies that will follow behind this study as part of the GNSO Council recommendations. Gaining registrant cooperation. I see representatives today in the room from the registrant constituency, and quite frankly, we couldn't be successful in this effort if our colleagues, such as John Berryhill and others, were not here to help support and move this work along in a constructive way. Thirdly, we really need to hear from the registrants, and whether that happens today or it happens through other feedback sessions, we want registrants to participate because this impacts their business as much as it impacts the business of all of those in this room today. And then finally, as we talk to you about the data analysis, the actual structure of the study, we're hopeful that if you haven't seen the proposal already from NORC, that you will take a minute and go out to our website where you'll find this proposal linked through the first page of the website. That proposal is essentially the material that we'll use today to get you informed and to get you comfortable with the approach that we're taking going forward. So here's how we're structuring the workshop. And of course, this is subject to change based on how the day goes and the participation that we receive from you. I'll lead off with a little overview of the purpose of the study. Then I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Khalil. Khalil is going to walk you through the ICANN joint approach with NORC, give you a little bit of the history behind how we teamed up with NORC and why we believe that's of immediate benefit and value to all the communities who are participating with us in the study. Cleo will also take you through a very thorough and in-depth discussion around the definition of accuracy. I think we've heard from many communities that it was important to define accuracy for purposes of the study and make sure that folks understand both the opportunities and the limitations that surround the definition as we go forward. Then Jenny Kelly from NORC will walk you through the sample size and provide you with an enormous amount of information on how NORC was able to construct and then ultimately, with help from ICANN, compile the sample size that will be most efficient for purposes of completing the study, which would also include the name and address verification methodology, which are essentially the principal tools by which the study will be performed. We'll talk to you a bit about deliverables, what you can expect to see coming out of the study. We'll talk to you about our budget, our timeline, and then finally next steps. And so I'd like folks to, you know, get prepared to talk to us about what's on your mind. And so, Bobby, I know that from the law enforcement perspective, there are issues on your mind. And we need to make sure that we hear about those issues today so that we think about, for example, the law enforcement implications of the Who Is Data Accuracy work we're doing and how that will ultimately benefit you and your community members. And I know that we'll also hear from others like John who will provide input from the registrar constituency in terms of whether we've got this right, and if we don't have it right, we need to make some course corrections or adjustments, we will. But with your help this morning, we're very confident that this will be a good workshop. And again, please, you know, stop us along the way, ask questions, get engaged. Purpose of the study. Many of you who have either read the proposal or who have been connected to this process know that ICANN initiated this work in late 2007. And Cleo will talk more to you about that in a minute. But in essence, you know, we are trying to focus around accuracy inside of WHOIS. And there are many data elements inside of the WHOIS database. And so it was a collective effort at ICANN and outside of ICANN with the help of other constituencies to really determine how we were going to go about undertaking this study. And so our approach was to focus on the total population of domain names within the top five GTLDs. And Jenny will show you more about what that means and ultimately why we believe that that is a very solid statistical representation for purposes of accuracy. So much so that NORC has told us that we can expect accuracy within a plus or minus 5% margin of error. And Jenny will take you behind the curtain and share with you a little bit of the statistical analysis that will actually formulate and deliver the kind of results that we hope will provide the accuracy or guidance that the community needs so that we can start thinking constructively about changes within the WHOIS database going forward. I would hope that everybody here would want to see the level of accuracy improved. Folks have told me that this has been a topic for at least 10 years, and I've only been with ICANN for about 8 months now. But I see many people in this room who've been engaged on this issue for a long time. And I think some of you know that the U.S. government actually commissioned a study in 2005. The General Accounting Office performed a WHOIS accuracy analysis. And Jenny will talk to you a little bit about that because a portion of our work is actually going to include a partial replication of the GAO study that was performed in 2005. And we think that that'll have immediate benefit not just for governments, U.S. in particular, but it'll have significant input into the deliverables that we produce as part of this study. And so what I'm going to do now is turn it over to Khalil, and Khalil's going to give you a little bit of the history behind how we teamed up with NORC, and then we're going to move right into the definition of accuracy and hope that you find this workshop this morning engaging, rewarding, and again, hopefully you will join with us not just today, but as we go forward to complete this study over the next several months. Thank you.
Thanks, Dave. Good morning. As Dave indicated, my name is Khalil Rashid, and I serve as ICANN's Compliance Audit Manager. And before we begin, I think a few thank yous are in order, first and foremost, to the community, because it has been a substantial amount of time since there's been an interest in the WHOIS data accuracy study. And it's also been some time since we've commenced this study, and I do appreciate your patience. In fact, the whole organization does. In addition, thank yous are due to both the registrar constituency and to intellectual property constituency in particular, who have had the opportunity to sort of help us and guide us along as we've developed this study and essentially collaborated with NORC. But just as I begin, as a few housekeeping matters, please, if you have questions, jump in. By all means, I do want this to be beneficial, interactive. But if you do, because we are audio streaming, I ask that you state your name, the organization or entity that you represent, and that you use one of the microphones. And if you're seated along the side, we have a microphone here which we can pass along. So without further ado, unless there are questions, why don't we jump right in. As you can see, based on the slide, ICANN initiated the Who Is Data Accuracy Study in November 2007, shortly, maybe a month after I joined the organization. So it was one of my initial projects. So I had to kind of come up to speed on what Who Is Data was and how we could formulate this study. It is now 2009, and ICANN is officially launching the verification data collection phase of the study. And you might wonder why. Well, we took several steps and approaches to how we would formulate this study. But a clear guiding objective that we used was we wanted to get it done professionally, and we wanted to have it done properly. And we wanted to do it in a manner that was not unnecessarily evasive to registrars and considered and properly balanced, registrants, but also balanced all the interest. So be it registrants, corporations, privacy, et cetera. In addition to the laws of various jurisdictions, which have various different privacy laws, regulations, et cetera, which ICANN had to be sensitive of and actually abide by. So with that in mind, we actually initially thought to do this in-house. So it was going to be an in-house ICANN staff-performed study. And maybe a month or two into the development phase, we realized we were not equipped with the proper resources to conduct such a study. At this time, we actually sought to collaborate with an internationally recognized private investigation firm based in the United States. There were several different considerations that we undertook when making that decision, but ultimately decided it was not in the best interest of the organizations or of the organization nor registrants to have private investigators in foreign countries contacting registrants about Who Is Data. And so we did not go that route either. Then we sought to collaborate with a professional, internationally recognized research institution, and we considered several, including this SRI, Stanford Research Institute, and the National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago. Ultimately, we decided to collaborate with the National Opinion Research Center because of the thoroughness of the proposal and the large scope, in addition to the previous experience they had, which Jenny will speak to shortly. And as you can see, if you've had the opportunity, and just by a show of hands, how many of people in this room have seen the actual methodology as proposed on our website? Okay. So one thing I would encourage that you all to do is to go visit ICANN's website, particularly the compliance page at ICANN.org/compliance, where you can actually access the methodology. It's there for your review. It's there for you to see. And if you have comments, please let us know. This is some time in the making, and we took several comments into account from various representatives of various constituencies, but still, we're always open for improvement. So again, if we could move, unless there are questions with that, I'll move into sort of the definition and how we developed that. There's a question. Sure.
This is Tim Chen with Domain Tools.
Sure.
And this is going to be a dumb question. This is my first ICANN meeting, so I'm really just looking for a very quick answer so we can move on to the point of your session. But just to lay that foundation for me, what can you tell me why what the purpose of Who Is Information really is, and therefore why accuracy is important? Because I come from the domaining side of the business, so to me it just seems like kind of a white pages for domains, which is great, but there's so many privacy protected domains out there. I don't understand what the purpose of accurate Who Is Information is, at least in the context of privacy protection, or just broadly in, you know, what does having accurate Who Is Information accomplish for the constituencies in this room?
Sure. You know, I don't know that the organization has ever commented on the actual purpose of WHOIS information. Historically, WHOIS information was used as a technical function. But since the evolution of the internet, the organization, I don't know that ICANN has come out with an official position on the purpose of WHOIS. And that's also not something that I'm prepared to do here based on that. If you do seek guidance in that area, I would suggest you contact our legal department. They may have some guidance.
So I guess who makes the requirement that WHOIS exists? Like, why is it my responsibility when I sign up for a domain that I have to enter my WHOIS information?
Well, the WHOIS information that that registrars are required to display is a function of the registrar accreditation agreement.
So it's ICANN policy that requires WHOIS.
Correct. It is an ICANN policy that requires WHOIS. And ICANN policy is developed through bottom-up consensus through the community. So we function as a resource for the community. And therefore,
who should I talk to answer the questions? It's ICANN's making this policy requiring WHOIS, right?
The community is making a policy. That's
somebody knows that there's a real purpose for this. It accomplishes something to have a WHOIS database. And who should I talk to at ICANN to answer that question?
Okay, as I stated before, as far as ICANN's official position on WHOIS, which I don't think the organization has ever stated publicly, I would contact ICANN's legal department.
Okay, I'll take it offline. I'm sorry, I don't want to waste the time of the group.
Thank you.
Can I even try to answer that question since ICANN won't? It's Holly Raish with the Internet Society of Australia, and there are probably several reasons. You would have heard one yesterday if you'd attended, and that is in a dispute in terms of who has rights. It's very important to know to be able to track back who's got the name, when the registration happened, otherwise you can't settle the dispute. From a crime perspective, and I'm surprised we didn't hear from some of the federal police, one of the real incidents of crime is you simply register a false name with a false credit card and then mayhem. So one of the things that the security community has been very aware of is we need to have real people with real credit cards and stop some of the security problems, which is another aspect of it. Then there's also the aspect of if you're trying to contact somebody because you may actually want to know or talk to that person or be involved with a person who has that domain name and it's fake or it's not correct, how do you do it? So there are probably a lot of reasons, and everybody in this table could probably give you and I'm sorry that ICANN doesn't have an official position on that. Maybe that's something that really needs to happen. But for a lot of people, there are different reasons why it's important for a lot of people. Just talk around the table and you'll probably get a lot of reasons.
There is one more question, but if it's related to this, I'd like to have it at the end so that we can move through the presentation and then we can pick it back up. That's okay? So right now I want to move along to the definition of accuracy as we envisioned it and developed it for this particular study. And this was actually with input from both the registrar constituency and IPC constituency. And as it reads, WHOIS definition of accuracy requires reasonable evidence of a correct name of current registered name holder. And NORC, which Jenny will go into more details about, will accurately identify individuals or entities that entered into registration agreements with the registrar. Now, just a little bit of contextual information around that I'd like to further expand on. So what we're looking at or considering accurate is a name is accurate or correct if it identifies the actual organization or individual that is consented to and entered into a registration agreement with the registrar, even though the registration might have been arranged by or created for the benefit of a third party. So is that clear as far as how we're looking at accuracy for the name or entity? Okay, I'll assume that is. And postal address, and again, we're looking at one data element, essentially, well, two data elements of WHOIS for the purpose of this study, which is sort of indicated in our proposal. And that is the name and address of the registered name holder. Now, there are several other elements of WHOIS, and there's actually additional WHOIS studies proposed. This is the inaugural ICANN WHOIS study, and so its scope is a little more limited. But as we expand and look at WHOIS in more detail and in more depth, we may expand what we look at as far as when we do WHOIS accuracy studies. So with respect to an accurate postal address, a little context there, a postal mailing address is valid if it accurately identifies a functioning destination for postal mail that has been designated by the registered name holder. There is no requirement that the address be the primary residence of an individual or headquarters of an organization. And for more, if you're interested in that information, I'm happy to provide that later as well. In addition, at the end, you'll also have my email address so you can contact Jenny, myself, or Dave if there are follow-up questions. So at this point, to get into more of the technical detail of how the study will actually work in the verification data analysis collection, I want to hand it over to Jenny and start there.
Okay. My name is Jenny Kelly, and as you've heard, I'm from NORC, but it might be helpful so you understand where I'm coming from to know a little more about my background. I've been in survey research and statistics for over 20 years. I started with the Bureau of Statistics here in Australia. I spent 9 years with them, and as a fully trained statistician, I ended up running their statistical consultancy area in the New South Wales office. Then I moved to AC Nielsen, which is a large international market research firm. I was responsible for running the government and social statistics division, and I was basically responsible, my joke is, for all the undoable surveys and the surveys from hell. So, and that included copyright surveys, drug use surveys, various business surveys. Then, after 8 years there, I joined National Opinion Research Centre. Initially, I was employed there actually as a chief troubleshooter to help get surveys on track, but in the process, I ended up also running their telephone survey and support operations. And support operations really mean data entry and locating services. We have a lot of surveys where we're following up people, some routinely every 2 years, some, for example, for the CDC, when there's been a suspicion of pollution affecting health 20 years ago, we've had to track down everybody who lived in a town or worked in a particular town 20 years ago. So we've got a lot of experience of tracking down people as well. Now, as far as this survey goes, when you start doing a survey, our focus of interest here is not so much on the registrants themselves, but on the domain names. So what we've done is look at what is the universe of domain names before we even sort of design the survey. Immediately out of scope, sponsored sites, the EDUs, the military, the government ones, because their information is quite separate. What we're concerned about here are any individual who wants to start up a domain name generally goes in with a .com, .net, .org type, .biz type name. And you can see the distribution in this pie chart of what is the current status of all domain names registered in WHOIS. The majority are .coms. Next is to look at the distribution by country. And the United States certainly has the lion's share. This is the number, what we've done here is because country isn't particularly easy to pull, we've taken a pure proportionate random sample and gone through and individually checked the country on each one. For 2%, we couldn't even get either WHOIS information or any indication of country. But for the rest, they were coded as this. Now, there will be, you know, a plus minus couple of percentage points difference on any individual one if you did go and pull every single record in WHOIS and code it accurately for country, but it wouldn't look very much different at all to this distribution. Now, why this is important is it affects how we're going to sample from countries. But this study gets done in about two stages. Half of it we do with basically desk research, so in a way that doesn't matter what country the domain name is associated with. But then once we start contacting people or trying to track them down, country does matter because every country has slightly different contact information, systems. You've got language considerations to take into account. And so, you know, the cost of just chasing one person in Romania, finding someone who can speak Romanian, finding what the setup, the system is for getting hold of contact information of people in Romania makes it very expensive. So to control costs, we cluster the sample. And this is a standard technique that's used in all government surveys. You cluster to reduce costs. So we clustered into 16 countries. And you can see this distribution looks an awful lot like the previous distribution that I put up. And you're saying, why are we bothering with Israel when there's only three? Well, that's the only... It's a very tiny representation. 1419 is our total sample size here. And that gives you... It's comparable, if you like. Think about all your election polling surveys. Most election polling surveys get done on around the 2,000 number of respondents. 1419, even when you build in the design effect by the that is caused by the clustering, it means at the end of this we'll be able to produce estimates saying, you know, X percentage of WHOIS records plus minus 2 percentage points or up to 5 percentage points each way, depending on the particular estimate, are accurate or inaccurate as the case may be. Without getting into, and we'll talk a bit more about the shades of accuracy that we'll be reporting, because I think for every person in this room there might be a different cast on what you think is accurate, and I agree with you, there's a lot of different ways of looking at this. And so what we're trying to do here is build a study that actually provides a lot of data and answers a lot of questions. So our general approach, the first thing we're going to do is do the coding and checking for the mailing address. The lovely thing about that definition, is it a valid postal mailing address, is that that you can pretty much do with database matches. So that's the first stage through. Then we're actually coding for registrant name type. There's a big difference in trying to track down a person. If you look in the WHOIS and you look at name, you'll get organisation names, you'll get person names, you'll get nicknames, you'll get complete blanks, all sorts of things. The way we actually search and find people very much depends on what have we got to start with. So there's a coding and classification routine there. The last stage we do is establish contact. As we're coding people and trying to find out about them, we're looking for also independent contact details, something that's independent from the information they've provided in WHOIS or in the website it's linked to. In some cases, obviously, we won't find that independent information. We might have to resort to going back through the administrative contact. We'll certainly be coding the independence of the information as we go, because obviously if I can find in the white pages a person at a particular address with a phone number, I ring that phone number, I find that person, I'm pretty sure I've got the right person. Whereas if I'm just relying on the information that's on the website, heavens knows who I'm talking to, and that needs to be reflected in the results. So first, coding address for type. Well, in the GAO study that was done a couple of years ago, they coded a three-level classification. The address was completely missing, or it was patently false, or it was something else. We're extending that a little bit. We're certainly coding for completely missing, and there's a couple of percentage points of people like that already. Patently false are things like where they've given the address as just a sequence of numbers, you know, something to get past the automated checkers, or they've given something really stupid where there isn't a city or a country of that name. Sometimes you get some information, like they might give you city or they might give you a street name, but not really enough to be able to classify further. Then when we actually think we've got an address that could possibly be mailable, it's classified either as a street or a physical address or a post office box. Now, if we go back to the definition of accuracy, if your street or a physical address or a post office box, and it's valid, then that's deemed an accurate address. However, for analysis purposes and understanding the data and the trends, it's nice to know the difference. People use PO boxes as a privacy measure, and the prevalence of people using PO boxes as opposed to physical addresses, that in itself and looking at the association or the correlation that has with eventual accuracy is something that will be of interest. So that's one of the reasons why we're bothering to make the separation. Also, it's a lot easier to find contact, independent contact information for people if they've given us a street address. Most white pages are listed by street address, not by PO addresses, for example. Next is a deliverability scale. Now, ideally, the address should be deliverable as given. However, even in surveys where I'm dealing with completely clean or apparently clean data, where nobody has a vested interest in lying about where they live, we find a certain number of people get their post office, their postcode wrong or their zip code wrong. Zip codes and postcodes sometimes get changed and the residents don't realise it, or streets get reclassified into a different neighbourhood or suburb. That kind of thing isn't really an inaccuracy as such. It's an easily corrected error. So in between deliverable as given and completely undeliverable, and for example, by undeliverable, I would say they've given us a city that doesn't exist or a combination of a street name and a city that doesn't exist. That's undeliverable. Between 1 and 4, there are a range of scales, and that we're developing as we go and we do the coding and we find what the errors are. For the United States, at least, we have a very nice little database program that the post office provides, which will rip through a list that you feed into it and spit back corrections, like it'll fix up the zip codes for you or the spelling of areas. It'll also highlight for you errors. For example, you're missing an apartment number and this address is an apartment building. So based on what we get out of that and what we get out of comparable things, systems for other countries, we'll be developing a code frame. And what we're kind of getting at there is, in that part of the purpose of who is how do you find and track down the registrant of a particular site, it's like, could a reasonable person track that person down even if there's this slight error, versus is this a complete crap address? Now we get into coding the registrant type. And again, we've got the GAO classification of name completely missing and name patently false. Now, we've had discussion before on, okay, is there really a person called Donald Duck? Or, there are people with completely ridiculous but valid genuine names. And so I'm going to stress here that this is an initial coding process. This is what do we think, and it's really to help us identify how we're going to treat that case going forward. Ultimately, though, we will be, when we get in contact with respondents or as we gather further information on them, we'll be refining and getting more accurate in how we've classified people. So if we do discover Mickey Mouse, who assures us that, yes, indeed, that's their legal name and we can find them listed in the phone book as Mickey Mouse, we'll change the rating from patently false to name as given. Now, I'm separating here. You'll see I've got natural person, ID card standard, and natural person other. One of the things about who is at the moment and the definition of accuracy isn't that you use a legal name. For example, I'm Jennifer Kelly on my passport, but professionally and on my business card, I'm Jenny Kelly. Jenny Kelly is, it's certainly not on my license or my passport, but people can track down a Jenny Kelly. On the other hand, if I just gave my name as J. Kelly or Jenny K or JK or any combination of that, then I'm no longer ID card standard. and I'm dropping into the next category. And the reason why we're making this distinction is that when you have first name and last name, it's a lot easier to go through databases and track somebody down than when you only have one name. A variation on this is going to be how to deal with common names. John Smith, for example, there's an awful lot of them. Actually, with the internet, I mean, you'll find that there's an awful lot of Jenny Kellys even out there. So part of this too is to work out, and this is we'll be working on this as we go through the study, how do we deal with quite unique, unusual names versus very common names that may look perfectly valid on the surface, but they're common precisely to make it harder to track the person down. We're also looking at distinguishing between registered businesses and other organisations. And at this stage of the coding, I've instructed the team to say, look, is it a name you think you can find in the Yellow Pages? Code it as registered. If it's got INC or Proprietary Limited or one of those business indicators in the title, put it in as a registered business. Other businesses that are so large that they go by just the straight name, for example, the store Macy's in the United States, then that you can probably find in the Yellow Pages. Again, as we get further in the process, as we're contacting people, we'll ask them to classify. There are a lot of names, though, in WHOIS that don't look like registered businesses, but they look like some kind of informal organisation. The Poker Players Club, for example. There's a lot like that. And that's an area, it can be accurate by the definition in the RAA, but it might not be actually what everybody wants going forward. And so that's why even at the end when we classify the Poker Players Club possibly as accurate, if in fact when we ring a phone number and we say we want to talk to somebody associated with the Poker Players Club, they go, oh yeah, that's me and my friends, that would still be accurate. But maybe it's we want to look at the incidence of those in there. I mean, going forward, and this is a much broader policy implication, I wouldn't be sort of getting into making recommendations here, but I want to provide the information that you've got so any of the policymakers can make a decision going, look, let's just require that it's a legal name or something along those lines. The reason why I bother with going person named or no person named is just simply if I have a person named as well as an organisation name, I've got two chances to track them down as opposed to just the business name. That only gives me one piece of information. So my next question is, how do I find independent contact information? Phone book is the obvious start. If I've got a first name, last name, or at least a last name, or the name of a apparently registered business, the phone book will be where we start. But we will be then going into, that might resolve maybe about 40% of the cases. We'll also do address matching. You can always take an address and go back and find a phone number for it. We do that a lot in our random digit dial surveys, that's where we go from phone number to address. We also do address-based sampling. We have an address and we're tracking down a phone number. I can tell you, you get lucky in about 40% of cases. Beyond that, we'll be going into database searches, and that will be using the sort of databases that in the United States, for example, the Accurant database is built from credit applications and gives you a nice little address history of people. It's quite useful. It can even give you friends and neighbours. Like, it might not have a current phone number for a person living at a particular address, but it will give you the phone number of the next door neighbour, for example. We'll use those sources as well. These are similar methods to what private investigation. It's the same sort of databases that private investigation firms use. But the big difference is that under our code of ethics, we never go in saying, John Smith has just won $200,000. If he rings me back at this number, I'll give him the money. You know, there's no pretexting involved. We'll also be using, you know, just straight Googling people. It's amazing what you can find on Facebooks and the various social networking sites these days. But whatever information we use, we're going to be keeping track of what the lead is and the independence of it, because again, at the end of the day, if somebody's using somebody else's identity and really trying to fudge their path, then we need to be able to distinguish between sources where you know that there must have been some kind of identity check involved versus those where it could, they can just provide the information, no questions asked.
Is the purpose of today's session to go into detail on, like, the method, the statistical methodologies that you're using, so we can understand what you obviously understand as a profession much better than any of us possibly could? Or is the purpose to go into why we're doing this and, based on whatever the findings are, what the outcomes might be, what changes we might make to WHOIS? Because that, at least, is much more interesting to me, and I'm guessing other people in this room, than detailed analysis of the database. But if I'm wrong, then other people, please chime in.
I'll answer that. While I respect that may be of interest, today's actual session is to inform the community of how we intend to conduct the study, and we can take that into account for future sessions if that is of interest.
In terms of the policy implications, I would say that by the time we've got a bit of data together, and that'll be at the Korean workshop, that will be drifting much more into here's the information. And probably at that stage, I would say that as a statistician, one of the reasons why I work more in the operations area now and not the research area is that I so much started discovering that the quality of the data, very much a number in a data set, always appears good. When you start digging below it and you've got to look at how it was collected and what its pedigree is, that's when you really get a sense of how reliable the data is. So I guess really today I'm talking about where the data's going to come from as opposed to what the data says.
But just to pick up the question earlier, I mean, I would have thought the users of WHOIS in the sort of context that we operate is the registrant sufficiently identified that you can track them down if you need to?
Yeah.
Whereas my impression is that you're descending into a level of granularity and quality of the data that doesn't seem to correlate with any particular user group's needs. So I guess, and I'm not sure if that's where the previous question was coming from, but I guess I'm trying to get an understanding of, on a cost-benefit analysis,
yeah,
where are you headed and why to that level,
okay,
of granularity?
I'd say that there are interests at both levels. The other thing is that there's amazingly little information at the moment on even how this information is used, what people use it for, what they think it's involved in. Part of the things that are, there'll be straight verification questions we'll be asking, but where registrants are willing, we're going to actually ask them a couple of additional questions by what do they understand about WHOIS? How often do they individually use it? I think this really is an explorer. Nobody really knows a lot about WHOIS, what the information is, how good it is, and even how it is used. Hopefully at the end of the study we'll have a little bit of that. You're quite right. I mean, sometimes it is just simply to get in contact with somebody. But in other cases, we heard yesterday from a legal representative that they wanted to go a lot further and sort of make sure that the information was accurate to the date of registration, which would help resolve intellectual property cases. So, yeah, we are going a fair bit more detail, but at the same time, we're trying to go into enough detail that will answer a lot of the broad uses that might come out of this, and also work out how to do further studies more cheaply. I mean, at some stage there should be a continual metric tracking some of this information. And if we find, for example, a good correlate of what indicates unreliable data, then you can just use automated database checks and you never have to talk to anybody again to just track that level. Does that answer your question, or?
There's also the history of all this, right? I mean, we tried WHOIS reform a couple of times, and it seems like each time we get there, we discuss it to a decision. And one of the points of agnosticism surrounding this is whether or not
Thank you.
Could I add to that? I think it's when you're talking about is the information good, I still think there's a question, and that is information which is good for what, which really gets back to what you're saying. We may find out that all of that information is terrific, but for the people who use it and need it, it isn't enough, or it's too much, or it's the wrong balance between privacy and accuracy. So somewhere in the data that you're getting, I think somewhere somebody's got to say, well, these are the uses to which that data is put, and then let's actually measure what it is we're asking for, and is that enough to meet the needs of the people who actually use it?
That's a really good point. I suppose we're doing it slightly different. I'm coming back with saying this is what you've got in the data. You've got accurate but relatively unusable for X percent, accurate, really good for Y percent, and not very good on other areas. I think part of the dialogue in terms of how do we want to use it, I do think that's a really big topic, although I think a lot of discussions on that point end up running into a wall because, again, they don't know what is there. So I would sort of classify this as just a straight baselining. Let's find out what's there. Let's pick up a bit of extra information while we're in the vicinity that we can cheaply and without annoying anybody too much, and then proceed from that point. So now I've got information on people. I'm going to start ringing them. The questions, what am I going to ask them? Well, I think the first thing is I'm not going to ever get lucky enough to get somebody to say, yes, that's a false name and I'm using it because I'm running a phishing site. What I will get for the majority of people, I hope, is, yes, that's me. And yes, I did register that site. So they'll be fairly, you know, boring but nice ones I can tick off. I'll get a couple, I hope, that will say, good heavens, I've never heard of that site. Now, then I've got a very interesting question on my hands. It's like, well, am I talking to the right person? And that's when it's like, well, do you go by this name? What do you know about this address? If it is indeed their name and their address, then I think we've got an interesting falsification or fraud case. If they say, whoops, I've never heard of that address, then I have a question mark in terms of, okay, I might need to keep looking for somebody else. So this is where I suppose I've got to say I'm not going to have a black and white entry at the end of the day. I mean, at some stage you do want a percentage that you can kind of put your hand on your heart and go, yep, 20% of the records or 80% are accurate. But it'll be accurate. It'll be accurate with qualifications, if you like. And there will be a group that in the end I'll say, I can't resolve. There's a lot of information that we have on each case by the time we say we can't resolve them. And that's, did they give us decent information? Were we able to, in who is? Is there any sign that, any indication anywhere along the way that this might be a fraudulent activity? What do we know? Is it a valid address? Have we been able to track somebody down? And, you know, one of our last resorts to get hold of the registrant is to go through the admin contact. I mean, that's the purpose of the administrative contact. Not a particularly independent source, but at least it will help us resolve more cases. Where we're not able to resolve them in the end, we're going to be reporting why they can't be resolved and where we think they might sit in the overall scheme of things. Now, the thing is, though, it's one thing to find out what percentage are inaccurate or have sort of vague information about them. We want to sort of get a little bit more into the why, because any policy implications out of this, you're going to need a little bit of information about the motivations to go forward. Again, we know that there's going to be sort of like a completely fraudulent subgroup that we'll never get much information out of. But I think there's also a large number of fairly honest, upright citizens who are just not giving particularly good information, and we don't know why. at this stage, and I'm hoping to enlighten that a little bit. Is it, you know, privacy concerns in that they're worried about people contacting them in relation to the website? Is it privacy concerns in that they're worried about people harvesting their information to put them on spam lists? So it's worth actually asking people these questions. They may or may not, you know, give us much information, but at least we'll have something more than what we started with. One of the other things is that I've been, you know, doing lots of little informal surveys among friends and acquaintances who have websites, just to sort of get a sense of who knows about Whois, because I must admit, before this study, I'd never heard of Whois. A remarkable number don't even know they haven't heard of it. They don't know what happens to their information when they sign up for a website. People aren't always very good at reading all the fine print and the conditions, and they don't know what happens to that information. So I'm actually kind of curious to find out if all the people who give us a really good name and really good address, did they know it was going to end up publicly accessible on Whois or not? And if we find that only a small proportion did know that, and of everybody who gives names like the Poker Players Collective, a high proportion of them know that the information ends up publicly accessible, then I think you've got something that will help policy going forward, because policy, you know, sort of in running my telephone shop of 1,000-odd people, it's my rule is that if too many people are infringing some rule, then there might be a problem with the rule rather than the people. Okay, now just a bit of a general thing here. How are we ever going to get people to talk to us? And I would say that that's part of what we do in surveys, is you get hold of people who don't necessarily want to talk to you, and you do persuade them that it's worth a couple of minutes of their time just to give you a bit of information. But there are sort of standard rules that help achieve this objective, and that's that you don't waste people's time. You don't put them through, you know, great long batteries of attitudinal things that take half an hour to get through. We're going to be keeping our contact down to under 7 minutes unless the respondent particularly wants to start talking more. We're going to use a semi-structured interview. I'm sure all of you at some stage, if you've ever been surveyed, have ended up being asked a question by an interviewer, and your answer doesn't fit into any of the pre-coded answer categories. And the interviewer is going to, you know, is forcing you all repeating the question three times to try and get you to shoehorn your answer somewhere. We're not going to be using that here. I'm using a very small team on this. I've got 4 people working on it at the moment. It might expand to 6 by the time we start the interviewing process. But the idea is that we'll be collecting this information in an unstructured form, and we'll be coding it down later, so we're not trying to shoehorn anyone on the phone. There's an issue of privacy too. When I release the results, it'll be in aggregate form, but I won't be saying which domain names or which registrants were involved. People, the survey industry certainly wouldn't last long if there was adverse impact to people as a result of the information they gave. It's a basic principle when you are trying to get drug use information out of people. They don't want to tell you that they've been using acid if they think that I'm going to hand the list to the police the next week. Similarly here, I need to give people assurances of confidentiality to get them to tell me why they perhaps didn't use their real address. The other thing is addressing their concerns about what will happen to their information and what we're doing with it. And we're working on sort of developing what I call the respondent relations information pack at the moment. And that'll probably be in the form of a letter that will be on ICANN letterhead that we can email or fax to people as they request, so they can, you know, get more information before they decide to talk to us. We also make it as easy as possible for people to talk to us. And so that's, you know, if we ring them at an inconvenient time, we'll ring them back. We'll have a toll-free number that they can ring us. We'll also use reverse charger systems, and we'll also obviously be using the, when we're getting into the international part of it, using people who speak the right language. Already on my team, because China and Spain are in the sample, I've got a lady from Beijing, I've got a guy from Madrid. So, you know, we already cover off a couple of the main languages in my current team, and we'll be expanding that as we go. So, now to the deliverables, and what do you get out of this? Well, a big thing is basically the baseline measures, as we've been talking about.
Just going back to that previous slide.
Could you state your name and organization?
Sorry, yes, it's Martin Boyle. I'm from Nominet, which is the .UK registry, but previously I was the UK government representative on the Governmental Advisory Committee. What you've put forward to us is that you're tracking people down, and therefore you've actually been able to follow a certain amount of address detail, and then you're going to be phoning people up to get them to respond. What you didn't say is what you expect to be a reasonable response rate from the people that you do track down and manage to get to talk to on the phone, and whether there are certain targets for achieving that, because otherwise you'll, you know, if people are not prepared to explain to you, that actually then throws a whole load of additional questions in. And then secondly, as a person who has started fairly recently working from home for a certain part of their life, I'm getting absolutely fed up with the number of people who phone me up with surveys. and that's why I'm actually wondering whether the technique underpinning is something that you have validated as being a way of getting a reasonable percentage of return rates.
Okay, that's a really good question. And response rates are indeed a huge issue. Of the studies that we're currently running in the phone shop at the moment, probably the largest one, we're getting about a 70% response rate. We actually, and depending on the type of study, you know, we're actually getting to screen 90% of the households we talk to in that particular study. It's just that a certain percentage of that 90% don't want to go on to what can be a 1.5-hour interview. We've done other studies that have gone to in the former prisoner study, for example, we got a 98% response rate, but they got a chance to complain about their conditions, so they were motivated. In this case, in some business surveys, you're really struggling to get up above 30%. But in this study, we're aiming for, and I think it's quite achievable, that we'll get, of people where we've got good contact information, we should be able to get about the 70% cooperation rate, if you like. Now, the other thing too is in terms of reporting, the only reason why statisticians get obsessed about response rate is what's called the non-response bias. So, for example, if we were doing a study of travel behaviour and I've sort of been in this particular situation, obviously people who are home more often are more likely to answer the phone, and therefore the estimates you produce of travel behaviour may be biased, because the ones who are travelling an awful lot are precisely the ones you're not getting to talk to. So that's where I always do a two-part exercise, if you like. One is that, you know, there is full disclosure and explanation of response rates, but the next part is always to do a non-response bias assessment to work out who are you missing and why. And then you can do a sensitivity analysis using that information and say, okay, well, let's assume that everybody who we're missing would have answered in this or would fall into this category. What would that do to our overall estimate? And then you also do it the other way, and that will give you a maximum bound of your range, and then you can start looking at the likelihood where people go. There's all sorts of additional subsampling techniques and other things we can do. Again, this will be something that we'll be working on as we go through and we start getting a sense of where it is. But you're right, response rates are going down, and all I can say is, please, you know, answer the phone.
Can I ask you a question about confidentiality?
Yeah. Okay.
I see an apocalyptic scenario where some enterprising lawyer uses a subpoena to get this and then goes through and tries to knock out a bunch of registrations. You know, so how are we making sure that people who are responding, the truth and confidentiality of their responses are actually going to be protected?
Okay. Very standard technique, and in fact required by our internal review board, institutional review board, is that we always strip the identification information away from the substantive response data. And it's always linked by a key, an ID key, that's totally meaningless on its own and that's kept separate and secure. So, for example, it means I can always work out who the non-respondents are and how to track them down. But when it comes to actually reporting or even releasing, if we need to, and we need to sort of assess this, but a public use file. And just to talk a little more about what I mean by a public use file versus a main data file, every statistical organisation generally, the really full juicy data set that that you use to produce the reports and the tables will have the full information in it. But when it gets to releasing something for public use, there's usually a confidentialization process that you go through, and it's fairly standard. It's not just stripping off the names and addresses, but it's sometimes checking the file for unique combinations that could identify somebody. So, for example, in the census, you will totally damp down high-end income, or just you'll group it up. You won't use... for example, it would be very easy to identify somebody earning $2 million in a particular suburb. It's much harder to identify that one person if you're only giving a whole state as a reference. So there's a lot of standard ways of going through and making sure that if you do produce a unit record file, which I've got to say is always useful for the user community, because sometimes tables don't do the particular cross tab that you're interested in, it will be confidentialised. And I've done that process for many surveys, so... David just made the point of who do we, you know, how do we declare ourselves when we're calling? The standard, we'll always be introducing ourselves as person's name, you know, their actual name. Our interviewers never use false names. Even you would all know that sometimes when you're dealing with a call centre and you ask for somebody's name, they might say, "I'm Melanie," and they refuse to give you a last name. Our standard is that our interviewers will use their first name, their last name. They say they are calling from NORC on behalf of ICANN. And we will have a letter, an ICANN letter, letterhead, explaining the survey, explaining why we're contacting them, that we will email out or fax to them on request so they can see it. We also encourage people, if they really want to know and check our credentials, to contact the front office, look at the websites, and, you know, we'll never press them to give us answers before they're comfortable with who we are. Yes, and there's probably a question about telling them who ICANN is as well. I mean, I imagine we'll be ringing a lot of people, and like NORC at the University of Chicago is partially known. It's not as recognisable as Gallup was, or for example, you know, it's, you often have to explain who you are, who the client is, and where we're all coming from. Must say though, I do like doing surveys for the CDC. Everybody knows who the CDC is, and yeah, they're always worried about disease reporting, so that's easier. ICANN will be a little harder. Okay. So I think, yeah, we'll just stop to the deliverables. I think we've talked about a report, a public use file. I think an important thing to note here, though, is also how granular the results can get. It's really tempting to kind of go, it'll be lovely to know if the inaccuracies are much greater in Korea, for example, as compared to Australia, or in Australia as compared to the United States. The sample size is not big enough for that. We'll be able to do a couple of large-scale subsets. For example, we can talk about accuracy among the United States domains versus the rest. We can talk about .com versus the rest. But I won't be able to actually go down and sort of talk about behaviours within some of those smaller domains, not in this sample size. Budget-wise, we're a not-for-profit company, and we're charging only for, you know, actual work done. We've got an upper limit that we're working within. If we can get the work done cheaper, we certainly will, and stop work earlier. And we're doing what we can to sort of increase the efficiency and the value of the data by, you know, for example, the byproduct is, you know, adding that GAO replication in. Since we have to code, the coding frame includes that anyway, then we may as well produce a nice direct estimate or a comparison. Now we're into timeline, and at this point I'm going to hand over to Khalil to finish off, and because I also appreciate we're running short of time, we've got a whole 15 minutes left now for Khalil to cover off the last few slides and deal with any additional questions.
Thank you, Jenny. So what we've packaged essentially in about an hour worth of time is about 16 months of work. So please forgive us if we kind of skipped over stuff or it wasn't as comprehensive, but it's a lot of work that brought us up to this point with your support and patience, so we thank you for that as well. Moving forward, what we essentially expect to do is have a preliminary draft report issued at the Seoul meeting. We launched the study, but we have not actually began the data verification process yet. And I'd like to speak to that briefly, because prior to commencing actual data verification and contacting individual registrants, ICANN plans to take a few steps internally to ensure the registrants have an idea of what's going on and that we have a contact readily available to address concerns if we're, should we be contacted, which we anticipate, by registrants and registrars. So in addition to posting on ICANN's website information about, in various languages, about this study, should a registrant be contacted, we'll have someone who can answer questions and some front desk staff who's been trained should we receive queries. So initially, the study will start with the U.S. data collection. During that time, we hope to make any course corrections. We anticipate receiving things that will require some change and some variation. You always have to sort of anticipate the unexpected. After which, we'll launch into the international data collection. Prior to releasing our findings, there will be a significant amount of time and energy on NORC's behalf devoted to compilation and analysis of the data that they've obtained. That will be, will serve as the basis for the final, for the preliminary report. We intend to present the preliminary report at the Seoul Korea meeting and actually issue our final report shortly thereafter. So next steps, as I've sort of just explained, this is where we are with the study. We plan to issue a preliminary report and a final report. If there are questions, I do want you all to have the opportunity to ask them if there are any final questions, so I'll stop now. I do ask, if you don't have a microphone, we have a cordless microphone circulating, so please state your name and organization, and we'll be happy to take any final Q&A. This will be a first. There's none.
Cindy Mickle, Lovells, Paris.
Hello.
How are you dealing with proxy registrants?
Sorry. Good question. I should have mentioned that. We're actually, because the definition is who is the registrant, where the proxy service is indeed the registrant, we're contacting the proxy service, or ICANN is actually, and asking them to confirm whether or not they're acting for that domain name. The reason why we need to put that in is there's probably quite a few people I suspect from looking at the addresses and the pattern in the data that some people choose to call their name proxy service or privacy service or private without actually using a genuine service. So at the moment, it's if they are we'll be contacting the service and checking whether or not it is indeed a proxy service and reporting it as accurate, but a subset again. You know, this is where I sort of say we can produce a single estimate at the end, but it's not really meaningful. What you probably want to do is say, okay, of everybody other than the proxy services, what is the accuracy? So that kind of information you will be able to drill down to in the report.
I would like to add a point there. Because of the significant issues associated with what are referred to as privacy and proxy services, the organization has actually commenced in conducting a separate study on privacy proxy services and their prevalence in who has data and registrations. And my colleague who's here, Mr. William McKelligott, I think will also be presenting a workshop in Seoul, Korea with the findings of that particular study. And again, this is not a who is privacy proxy service, but more who is data accuracy study. So we don't delve into it deeply, but my colleague's study will.
Hi. This is Bobby Flame from the FBI. And this was a good study, but to follow up on what you just said, I think some of the other concerns that we have or are interested in is, number one, what you just said, the use of the privacy and proxy services to see how they're used, if they're engaged, you know, people who use these services are engaged in any nefarious activities, there's criminal activities associated with them, and what the percentage of natural persons use these privacy and proxy services. Because one of the big issues concerning national laws and privacy issues concerns natural persons, that their data has to be protected. And we certainly understand that. So we also wanted to know, or one of the questions is, what is the percentage of natural persons engaging in non-commercial activities are actually registering domain names, as opposed to people who are engaged in commercial activities registering domain names, and also companies, if there's like a percentage or a breakdown or a statistical study of that, because that would be very important too. Because I think we have, there's a lot of questions. We obviously want to make sure that we're abiding by national laws, but we don't want anyone to be hiding under these laws, you know, claiming privacy when they really don't, or they're engaging in criminal activity. Some of the other things, one of the other things, is it going to be part of the study or a future study insofar as how to actually correct the problem, insofar as what you'll see to have greater accuracy, what needs to be done to have greater accuracy, and so on and so forth?
So let me start with your second question. The purpose of this Who Is Data Accuracy study is first and foremost to inform compliance activities and to meet a community need, which has been there for some time. There are several other proposed Who Is Data Accuracy studies or Who Is Data studies within the organization currently under consideration, which have been recommended by various constituencies. Again, this is an actual compliance department study and not a policy or GNSO study. So some of the studies which you are referencing, I think, might be better placed in a different area within the organization. And I know that some of them are currently under consideration.
Okay. So is for the contractual compliance, are you just doing accuracy, I guess, studies, and all the other who is studies would be, I guess you're referring to GNSO, what they're looking into. Is it going to be their responsibility to do those studies?
No, I hope I didn't give that impression. I know that other studies are under consideration.
Okay.
The studies you mentioned are not currently under consideration by the compliance department.
Okay. Will they be, or like how would we...
It is unlikely that they will be under consideration by the compliance department due to the nature of our particular mission. They may be by the GNSO, and I would check with the GNSO representatives at ICANN. Okay. I do know that some. And I don't mean to avoid your question.
No.
But
totally
I do know that there are some studies under consideration. I don't know which, so I'm not comfortable addressing them.
Okay.
Yeah, Bobby, I can tell you that compliance will be involved, though,
in each one of those additional Who Is studies. We have both a supporting and an active role to play in that work because the results of those studies will affect contractual compliance policy and contractual compliance enforcement activities going forward.
James, why don't you use my mic? Come on.
So, James Bladel, GoDaddy, and thank you for this presentation. Ms. Kelly, I think a few slides back you mentioned that there was question where if you were able to contact a person, and it was a legitimate person with a legitimate telephone number and address, but they weren't aware of the domain name, that you would tend to flag or consider that as a possible fraudulent situation. And I would just remind everyone that there are a variety of products and services, whether it's a vanity blog or email address, where a person may be registering a domain name as part of another paid service that's taking their existing information and populating that into a Whois database, and they may not be aware of that at all. So I just wanted to put that out there, that may not be a valid conclusion in all cases to draw when you have a legitimate person that does not know a domain name is registered in their name.
Okay. A question then about how we might deal with that. Is it possible to get a list the idea would be to hand over the domain name to the appropriate registrar and ask them to give us information?
Possibly, but it could be one or more levels of resellers or application developers involved in between. I'm just pointing out that it's not a simple A to B jump between that situation and fraud.
Okay.
There could be a variety of other mitigating situations.
That's a good point. Thank you.
All right, I'm Sigmund Solaris from Assorted.com. First, I guess, back on the point you were just making, as one example, if you buy a Dell computer sometimes, you'll get a free domain from Microsoft. And so if you go to look at the actual domain name, you can often find out and say, okay, this is a template site, and you can find out, you know, how they got it. But I have one thing. My question was, what's the estimated cost of the survey? I don't know if I've missed that.
Top limit is $195,000 for all consultancy work and data collection.
Okay, and you know, getting back to what the FBI was asking, it would seem to me like it would be pretty easy to say, okay, we're going to look at domains that have a history of spam, domains that have a history of phishing, and then just say, okay, we look at 50 of these and see, you know, what's the relative percentage of accurate information.
That'd certainly be a good separate study. It's sort of within the scope of this one, that would be difficult to do, but I do think that, that's a good way of approaching that.
And that actually provides an add-on opportunity, towards the the conclusion of the study, because when we come forward with recommendations and next steps, it may very well be that this study will require additional baseline expansion into the areas you've just described. So I don't want to leap to that conclusion, but I do want to acknowledge that is a potential next step or link as a result of our work here.
And there's also a microphone. Could someone please? Okay, please.
My name is Kathy Klein, and I'm a co-founder of the Non-Commercial Users Constituency. And among the members of our constituency are human rights groups all over the world who are posting important political information, important human rights information, important amnesty information, and by putting their address in the Whois database may be threatening their own lives or the lives of their families if they're not in the country at the time. I've worked with many, many organizations throughout the years with this problem. So my question for you is, and I apologize if I missed it because I'm just coming in, but I was a member of the predecessor committees in Whois for many years. So what I'd like to know is, to what extent are you tracking the privacy and data protection laws around the world? And what do you know about the data protection commissioners who have come to speak before ICANN in the past and what they've said? How are you tracking non-commercial and human rights organizations in the database? How are you tracking the political speech rights laws that exist around the world, including a right in the United States of anonymous political speech that's been upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court. And again, just back to how are you tracking legitimate, non-commercial human rights and political use of organizations? Thank you.
Okay. A lot of that is just outside the scope of this study. But one thing I am wondering is, it sounds like one, a variable that might be useful in the for the data is to classify any website that a domain name might lead to. And, yeah, okay. But that's as far as I could take it in this study. So is your question probably more for ICANN then on other activities beyond the scope of this study?
Well, is privacy part of the scope of the study? And what would you mean by classifying websites? Sorry.
Just that if, like, let's work from the hypothesis that this is sort of related to the last two questions as well. We might end up with a bunch of domain names where we can't verify the information or where it appears to be false. And they might all be human rights sites or they might be all criminal sites. Is there a way that we would be able to distinguish that from the nature of the website they lead to? Because it might be that in itself, I think, would be a useful finding to say, hey, all the inaccurate ones were human rights sites.
Plan to go from the domain name to the website? Because some of that, not all that information would be available on the face of the Internet. A lot of it might be. So I think that's a good idea.
Okay.
To take it that one step further.
Okay.
Thank you. This is just a follow-up to a point made by my friend. If your sample, 1,400 or whatever it was, if they just happened to be 1,400 that were reasonable, on the other hand, we know 50 or 100 websites where spamming and all this phishing is happening, and you miss those 50 or 100, then wouldn't your study be a qualified or qualified study? And the other just quick question is, I'm new here, so I miss the CDC. I only know Center for Disease Control.
That was the Center for Disease Control.
Okay.
And totally unrelated to this study, it's just one of my other clients that is fun to do work for because people, are quite excited to get calls from them. I'm not sure that they'll be quite as excited to get calls from ICANN. But the question about the sample size. The sample size of 1,400, it's actually a pretty good sample size in terms of, you're right, there's rare ones that it might totally miss. But if they're that rare, you would need to go to a different, much larger study. And this is where you start trading off samples with censuses, for example. Most countries conduct a census every 5 or 10 years. The reason why they don't do those more often is that they cost a bomb. They're really expensive to do, and you can't go into much detail with them. So what we're trading off here is kind of depth of information versus a larger scale exercise. Now, what it will do is inform further studies. There might be... What makes this study expensive partly is it's the first one being done. So, there's a lot of sort of development and exploration work, but there's also that locating and contacting people component, which is labour intensive. What I'm kind of hoping to do out of this is to basically find out if there's ways to subset the more suspect cases, if you like, and work out at what point then that automated checking might be used on a much larger sample. So, I think this sample will give you a good general picture of what's going on, but to get into those particular subgroups, that's actually a different kind of design.
As far as, and this is Sigmund from Assorted.com again, as far as classifying the different sites, I know some of the registries have done things like say, okay, 20% of my sites are active or, 20% of them don't even have an active web page, 20% are e-commerce sites, 20% are Fortune 1000 companies or whatever it is. Obviously, you can't have 20% as Fortune 1000 companies, but, you know, and then however many are personal.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are ways. You might want to talk to some of the registries, or you just go look at the website, take 5 seconds, and if you can't classify it, move on.
Yeah, I agree.
Can you hear me? Yeah, there we go. Rod Rasmussen, Anti-Phishing Working Group. On the sampling, one of the issues with criminal use of domain names is those domain names are actually very short-lived, right? So I apologize if I missed that earlier in your presentation, but are you looking at doing a distribution where you would be able to include several more recently registered domain names? Because they do get deleted very quickly when they're doing hosting criminal activities.
Yeah. One of the variables I think we will be looking at is whether or not, how long, using the date of registrate, I'll be looking at the longevity of the site, if you like, as an additional classifying variable. I mean, all the information that we've got in WHOIS we'll be using. We did use, the information we extracted was, done in late April. And so, if you like, it's frozen at that point. I imagine that the ones that might be questionable would have been ones that maybe were registered only a couple of days before that site. And so we'll report that as well, saying, can we actually get a correlation of accuracy by whichever measure with longevity, and that'll be part of it.
Philip Argy from argystar.com. Spoke a bit yesterday in the session, but just a follow-up question. The UDRP panelists, as we said yesterday, have an enormous amount of exposure, I guess, to a certain cohort of user. And in terms of additional things you can classify, I mean, I issued a decision a few months ago, a US incorporated respondent, which can admitted it had 10,000 domain names registered all through a proxy server. And I sort of expressed the view I couldn't really understand why a US corporate entity would need to have 10,000 names registered through a proxy privacy service. The decision went against the respondent, found to be abusive. But I'm wondering if there's some additional correlations that would be thrown up by your survey if you added a couple of extra observations, like the website or like how many other registrations does this individual have if you find they're using a proxy service, because in terms of the legitimacy at one end of the spectrum for those with bona fide human rights and privacy concerns, there would probably be a vast number at the other end of the spectrum who are using it to mask nefarious activity. And oftentimes, the number of registrations held by the same person is a guide to that.
Now, while I'm sure we could expand the scope significantly, right, to include various different elements of interest to the community, it would come at a significant time and cost. Again, this is the inaugural study, and there are several other studies proposed. So this study will focus on the WHOIS data accuracy of the registrar and name and address. And so that's pretty much where we are with that. But as far as future consideration, we are open.
David, this is Tim Chen again from Domain Tools. This question is really back to you, and this is the last thing I'll say, and then I won't say anything else. I think you're hearing two things. This is a workshop, so you asked for feedback. I think you're getting feedback, good feedback here. You know, on a tactical level, it's clear that this study is pretty boxed. It's an accuracy study of the current WHOIS. I get it. It's very well defined. A lot of these questions are, I guess, off point because they're trying to look for the next step. So on this, I would just say, to the extent that you understand, getting back to my first question, why WHOIS accuracy is important. I'm not sure you do. I'm not sure I do. But if you do, one kind of category of feedback that I'm hearing is there's a lot of people in this room who have very good feedback on, you're probably going to find most of the things are pretty good, and then there's this group that doesn't want to be found and is abusing, or maybe not abusing, working within the WHOIS regulations to not be found either through privacy or through bad information. There's a lot of people in this room who understand exactly why those people are doing that and, how they're using the system. That's great feedback. If you want to get to who is accuracy, I think you're hearing people saying you should think about a study focused on just those bad actors. Whether or not you want to do that, I'm hearing that from a lot of people here.
Yeah, and, we'll put that aside. Right, and as are we. And I think that that's been the value of today's session, is that we're getting the kind of constructive feedback that we need to think through what the next logical steps would be.
Great. The other point that I would say is, on a much broader scale, some of, I think, what the FBI's points may have been, or my points, or the lady in the back with the human rights issues is, you know, what's the next step? I thought I was coming to a group or a session where I could talk to the people that are interested in making possible improvements to the WHOIS system, changes to WHOIS policy at some point. That's clearly not this session. But what I'd like to know, and I think some people here would also like to know, is who do we talk to about that? So let's say that there's an outcome that says, you know, we need to really think about the WHOIS regulations, possibly rewrite them in the RAA because of the abuses that we find. Who would be responsible for doing that at ICANN, so next year or in Seoul, I can go to the correct session or talk to the right people who will give me an answer that's not like our study is just this, but it's like, you know, we're thinking about these things for WHOIS, and either GNSO or whoever it is thinking about policy for WHOIS over the next couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And I think once we do arrive in Seoul and we've shared the results of our work, you know, the next step in the process for you is going to be to not only chat with our policy team, but also with the legal and compliance team. It's not as simple as saying that there's one department or one team that you can go to inside of ICANN to address this issue. It's really going to be a collaborative effort between our policy team, our legal team, and our compliance team as we postulate recommendations from this study. And I hear what you're saying today in terms of what those next steps ought to be. So you're just slightly ahead of where we are at the moment. But we're all moving in that same, you know, consensus direction, is that this is the first time that this work has been undertaken. And so we're trying to do this right to make sure the baseline is useful for other studies that will follow, as well as for some of the anticipated policy, contractual compliance enforcement work, and most likely some of the legal issues that will arise in the future, so that we're prepared to address those head on and bring about some constructive change around WHOIS in the future. That's our goal, constructive change around the WHOIS database in the future, once we understand the accuracy of the information inside the database. And I hope that answers the question. Yes, in the back of the room.
Kathy Kleiman again. Just wondering if the study is going to have a separate evaluation of the technical contact information, because just on the other side of the tug of war is the idea, again, of a registrant data and kind of the history of the world. No one's ever had to put their name and address and phone number and personal email in order to share a political message. So the registrant data is a great concern from a privacy perspective and human rights. But if the technical contact data is accurate, then there's a direct way to find the registrant. So is there a separate evaluation of the accuracy of the technical data, the technical contact data in the WHOIS database?
Not at this stage, mainly because that just would have expanded the study from looking at the accuracy on two data fields to the accuracy on all the various data fields associated with the admin contact and the technical contact. That would probably be, depending on what comes out of this study, that may well need to be another assessment or part of the next design.
It's probably fair to assume, though, that anyone who's got a false or inaccurate registrant data is not going to give you valid admin or technical contact data for the same reason.
Yep, I'd agree with that.
Okay, so if we don't have any other questions, I think Khalil wants to just wrap up now because we're about 10 minutes over. But, you know, again, I want to say thank you. You know, this is an important first step, and I appreciate everyone who came here today. The time you took out of your schedule to contribute. And, I would encourage you to stay connected with us. This is not just a snapshot or moment in time, and then, you know, we move forward without you. Our contact information is available on the ICANN website. Please use it. Stay connected with us. Give us your feedback, and let's make this the very best study and work product we can collectively. We'll also have brochures on the back table that'll give you just a brief update on some of the activities surrounding the contractual compliance team, including our work on the WHOIS accuracy study. And I'll just let Khalil make a few closing remarks, and then we'll adjourn.
No, because we are 10 minutes over, I want to adjourn so people can get to their next meetings. Again, I do want to reiterate everything Dave said, as well as thank everyone who's participated in the process and provided comments here today. Please continue to follow the updates as we post them on the website as well. We generally post each developmental phase and next step on the website, so please follow that as well. Thanks again.